Mark, thank you very much indeed for that warm welcome. Thank you for having me here this morning. It's great to be with you. I was through at the Solent Gospel Partnership just last week, so it was great to be there. I think we had a good morning together. Well, anybody remember this film? Anybody recognize it? Shout out. Any idea what it was? Oscar nominated. The Magdalene Sisters. That's right. Yes. Set in Ireland in the 60s. The hit movie, The Magdalene Sisters. It follows the fortunes of four women trapped under a brutal regime of po-faced Irish nuns running one of Ireland's infamous Magdalene laundry asylums, named after a repentant prostitute, reputedly. In fact, hundreds of these asylums for fallen women operated across Ireland, Europe, and North America for the best part of 200 years. And today we recall these fallen women who were put into these asylums, single mums. But as recently as the 1960s, when this movie, which is the period this movie characterizes, the shame of being a single mum would keep these women, thousands of them, out of sight, working in these laundries, sometimes for years on end. And sometimes their children were forcibly put up for adoption. And in fact, the Catholic Church issued another apology just 3 weeks ago to that effect. Now, of course, this is a kind of an extreme case, but it illustrates something of the cultural scaffolding of shame that had been built around immorality and divorce and children out of wedlock, a scaffolding of shame in our culture that remained firmly in place into the 1960s. We know, though, that as the events of this movie were taking place, the early 1960s, the West was on the threshold of a social and cultural upheaval that would see every one of these asylums closed in just 30 years. The last one closed in 1996, in fact. A mighty sexual revolution was about to be unleashed with such speed and intensity that actually looking around us today, just half a century later, the cultural landscape has changed from those days beyond all recognition, hasn't it? Today, nearly as many births take place outside of wedlock as inside. In socially deprived areas, especially among the poor, and the poor, and we'll come back to this, are those that have been most affected by the cultural revolution. That proportion, some inner city areas in Liverpool, Belfast, that proportion's risen to 2/3, fatherless wastelands. And marriage itself, again, especially among the poor, has entered a deep and prolonged recession. Look at how the number of divorces and its kids and its poor kids that isn't a picture we just need to bear in our mind. But look at how the number of divorces rises. There we are. That's when the film is shot, or not shot, but rather that's the period that it captures, 62. Then the revolution gets going, and we see that over the next 30 years, the rates, the numbers of raw divorces escalate sixfold. And then it levels off, actually. It dropped ever so slightly, but it's broadly leveled off. And so we might be tempted to say, so what's the problem? But if we look at these data, we might begin to understand why the numbers of divorce leveled off, stopped rising. Any ideas? Fewer people getting married to get divorced. And here we have the rates, so we've still got the number of divorces here going up, but as you can see, as the number of divorces goes up, the number of marriages begins to fall. So as the number of marriages begins to fall, the number of divorces plateaus off. And cohabitation and sex outside of marriage is a kind of a new norm in our society. I seem to have met a series of young Christian couples who got married in their early 20s who've struggled to make the case for getting married in their own families, sometimes Christian families, because it's so profoundly countercultural to get married if you're 23, 24. And listening to them describe what the pressure they've had, I thought, goodness me, that at best what you are doing is viewed in our culture as being irresponsible, and at worst, almost something immoral about it. Such has been the change. And today, two people of the same sex can get married, and anyway, we're actually no longer sure what sex, being male and female, is anymore. So in the space of just a few decades across much of the West, centuries-old convictions rooted in the biblical moral code have effectively collapsed. And the reality we've got to come to terms with, friends, is that most people today out there would probably say good riddance. And church people are shifting. Your people are shifting. If not in their heads, in their hearts. They're not articulating their discomfort and some of the feelings that they're having about this. But they're certainly feeling it. They're very, very uncomfortable about whether what we have is still good news in this area. And you see it particularly reflected amongst young evangelicals. In fact, I was up in Keswick in the summer, and lots of grey heads like a few of us there who and Keswick Middle Week is still a bit grey, you know, were coming up to me and saying, this is so helpful, this kind of material we're talking about this morning, but I just wish our grown-up son and his wife were here, because they're evangelicals, but they just don't see what the issue is with gay marriage. And, well, here's a snapshot data. If you look at, this is of young evangelicals, supposedly a quick and dirty survey from the Evangelical Alliance. The definition of a young evangelical is anybody under 40 who goes to church at least once a month. And you might say, it's pretty accurate, actually, for young evangelical. But no, I don't think it is. But you can see it's tapping into a certain constituency. So a big pinch of salt needed. But sexual intercourse outside of marriage is always wrong. One in three aren't sure about that. And not sure that that's true anymore. And, of course, on the hot-button issues, homosexual activity is always wrong. More than a half are either not sure or say, no, I don't believe that anymore. That is not part of my moral landscape. So things are on the change. Of course, we shouldn't be surprised, because for several years, many Christian leaders have looked like rabbits caught in the headlights on this. We seem to be hoping that if we keep our heads down, the whole business will somehow just go away. But it won't. We sit here like King Canute, don't we? And the waves just keep on coming. So here's the question I want to put to you this morning. And by the way, I've already posted these slides. So I'll give you where it is, and you can just download them at the end with some extra resources and some of the data that justifies some of what I'm saying. So just if that would free you from making too many notes, you can just download them all. But here's the question I want to put to you this morning. In Matthew 19, we have that great foundational text, don't we? Mark 10 as well, and Matthew 5 similarly. And Jesus said this, "Have you not read that from the beginning the Creator made them male and female, and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, And the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Now, traditionally, that belief has framed the conviction amongst Christians that marriage is not a human invention. It is something given, ordained by God in creation for all of humankind. And more than that, even getting married is not a human process. It is something that God does. So when two people come together, what God has joined together, let no man try to separate. And for many, many centuries, waxing and waning a little, but that belief broadly has anchored the traditional conviction that all forms of sexual activity that lie outside of that covenant fall short of God's will for humankind and are effectively sin. Now, my question's this. For those of us who remain convinced that the traditional reading of this text is a non-negotiable of Christian identity, Bible people, question is this: what does the future hold for your beliefs, do you think, really? Well, let's turn it round a bit. What are you going to do to make this belief plausible, comprehensible to this culture in which we sit? How can you and I begin to tell a better story? That's the question that's going to occupy us for the rest of this morning. Well, how do we get started with it? Well, what I want to suggest is that we need to start by listening a bit more carefully to our culture and watching it a little more. What is it saying to us? And as we observe this mighty revolution, which has deconstructed so much of what we hold dear, what's the secret of its power? As you watch it and listen to it, ask, what's the secret of its power? You know the political theorist, Joseph Nye? Anybody heard of him? He's the guy who invented the terms hard power, soft power. And he said, what gives nations power and influence in other cultures? Well, there's hard power, you send the troops in. But then there's soft power. And soft power, he said, is the ability to get what you want using attraction. Soft power is what makes your ideas, ways of life, and values attractive to people. Now, as we know, the stormtroopers of this sexual revolution have been pretty adept at using hard power. I've been on the receiving end of some of that hard power, coercive power. And if your teenage daughter were unwise enough to say something negative about, for example, gay marriage on if she had shared her Christian conviction on Facebook, she would very quickly experience something of the hard power, the coercive power of the revolution as she's unfriended one by one. Happened to somebody I know, said my daughter, she's just unfriended. And for a teenager, that is really hard. And that's an example of hard power. And we feel that. And so the culture wars has drawn us into fighting the hard power of the sexual revolution. But what I want to suggest to you this morning is that the real secret of its power isn't its hard power. It's actually its soft power. It's what makes it attractive to the human heart. And we haven't begun to get our heads around that. So let's suppose I'm right, and you can chip in and with some other thoughts in a moment. But let's suppose I'm right for a minute. So what are the sources of this soft power? What does it look like? Well, there are lots of things we could say here, but I'm just going to focus on two areas that I think are quite important. First, it's compelling moral vision. Second, its particular ideology of individualism. Both of these are just the sources of the revolution's soft power. First of all, its moral vision. Let's take that. Because I think that this, more than anything else, is what caught us off guard and unprepared. Because, you see, when it comes to kind of questions of morality, Christians, like us, have been accustomed to occupying the moral high ground. In the past, it wasn't difficult to denounce deviations from traditional moral convictions. It wasn't hard to point to the evils of pornography and broken homes and sleeping around, because it fed into a broad public moral consensus. I mean, everybody knows that under the bonnet, people didn't really do this stuff. But publicly, the public moral consensus, I mean, whether you're looking at that series Crown at the moment, that television series, but it is striking, you see, how a king abdicates because of divorce. And then Princess Margaret says, mindful a few years later, where she's in exactly the same situation, can she marry a divorced man? Mindful of the teaching of the church. And she's forced to give up Peter Townsend, isn't it? So that's an example of a broad moral consensus that made it very easy for us as Christians to denounce immorality, you see. So when the revolution really got going, we thought it would be business as usual. We expected to be able to portray our opponents as moral anarchists bent on depravity. We would cast their narrative as immoral or amoral. But far from kind of unveiling a Dantean nightmare of debauchery, the revolution cast an inspirational vision of authenticity, being real, and freedom, and fairness, and equality, and justice for the little people who've been sat on by the big people like you and me for too long. And it cast us, you, me as the degenerates, the immoral, the bigots, the small-minded people who stuck young girls whose crime was having a baby. When the guy walked off and we stuck and we shamed these women into these asylums. And that was Christian morality. Well, the revolution came along and it says, it's time to be free of all of that. Hugh Hefner, who started Playboy, said, I started this magazine partly in response to the Christian upbringing that I had of shame that shackled the human spirit. Another of the doyens of the early sexual revolution said, when you hear some Christians talk, Don Schrader, he said, when you hear some Christians talk, you think God created the head, the torso, and the legs, and the devil slapped on the genitals. These people are shame-filled people, and they like shaming people and pushing the people who don't fit and who have the effrontery to be a bit different from them out into the margins. Bigots. And we're having to come to terms with that reality, that we are an immoral minority. Forget moral majority. Let me give you an example. Take a gay pride event, something like this. So that's the vision that I'm suggesting, that they're the values that motivate the revolution. But take a gay pride event, you see. Now, on the face of it, this looks easy for us. Faced with images like this, Christians, business as usual. Our default is wrinkle up our noses, talk about AIDS, and hold another seminar on pornography, which is all we ever do, hold another seminar on pornography. But you see, people aren't actually listening to that kind of language anymore. Today, images like this actually convey virtue. The virtue of being real, being honest, not covering up anymore. The virtue of saying, you continue in your hypocrisy and your shame if you want. But this is who I am. So You see, this isn't simply about the well-being that people say follows being real and not covering up and just saying, look, let's be real about it. It isn't just about well-being. It's about its intrinsic virtue. There's something moral about being true to who you are. And so today's moral priorities pivot around those key values of freedom, authenticity, justice, fairness. And we, biblical Christians, don't seem to have a moral vocabulary that talks the same language, that's capable of engaging with these very individualistic concerns. We appeal to general principles, rules, and God says. And in the Bible, marriage is a picture of the love that Christ has for his church, and we present people with such difficult concepts that they don't know how to relate to these big rules. They say, I don't know about your big rules, but I do know about my nephew, and he's gay, and I don't understand why you people, if marriage is so good enough for you, because you say marriage brings, it grows us up, it grows promise keeping, well, why isn't it good enough for him? You see? And we say, oh, well, the rules, you see, the rules up here. You say, they say, forget the rules. I'm talking about my nephew. And he's a nice boy. In fact, when I look at some of your people, I think he's a bit nicer. And we don't know what to say to that. So we'd have two languages. We talk about rules and big principles and transcendent pictures, which are hard for people to get their heads around. And they talk about individual people. Nice people, funny people like you see in Friends on telly and Will and Grace. And my nephew, they say. And what they don't see is how your rules work for him or her. And when they say, how does it, we kind of dry up a bit. And because we don't have the same language. And when we do flush out our Christian leaders to issue some kind of statement on, you know, like the bishops, please say something about marriage. What they issue reads more like the terms and conditions of a software upgrade than a vision for personal flourishing. And arguably, somebody said, Will and Grace, you know, that program, did more for gay marriage than arguments ever did. It wasn't arguments that got gay marriage. It was stories, you see. So there we have this moral landscape that we're sitting in, and it's not amoral or immoral so much as looking at moral concerns in a different way, and it's one that we don't seem to be able to talk to very well. So first, a compelling moral vision. Then, so we're looking at the two elements of the revolution, soft power, okay? Second, that its ideology of expressive individualism. Now, what's expressive individualism? Well, let's take individualism first, okay? In a nutshell, individualism is about the value of thinking for yourself compared with what you're being told by other people. It's what I decide to be true versus what I contextually am told is true. Individualism elevates the authority of the individual to make up her mind. And of course, we'd say, well, that's good. It's good to think for yourself. The perspective, in fact, is rooted in Christian thought. God cares about the individual. He holds the individual responsible. And he calls us to fight for the individual, for injustice. But you see, modern individualism goes a step further, or expressive individualism, as it's sometimes called, because it tilts the balance of authority between my context, tradition, the wisdom of tradition, and what I think. It tilts the balance decisively in favor of the individual. It insists that our highest loyalty is our loyalty to the self. It's an imperialism of the self. And we see it most acutely in the area of personal identity. But it's called expressive individualism because it pivots around the belief that within every individual there's an inner you, a real you. And people are always trying to impose their pictures of who you are on this real you inside. And what you need to do to break free is to get in touch with the real you and express the unique you in here. Look within. Look, discover who the real you is. And regardless of what they tell you and what the wisdom of the ages is and what the church and philosophers and politicians say, you express, look inside, what you see there, be real, be authentic, you see? And we see this most clearly in the sphere of personal identity. What's that? Well, one of the most profound questions we'll ever ask is the question, who am I? And identity is simply how we answer that question. And as we've seen, expressive individualism says you answer that question by looking within to discover your unique self and express what you find there, and that is who you are. And if external reality doesn't fall into line with what you find in there. Now, in the past, you'd say, well, maybe I'm wrong. If it doesn't fit with reality, if what I'm being told, they say, no, if external reality doesn't fit, change reality, not yourself. That's the sacred thing. So how does that work out? Well, let me give a couple of examples. According to the New York Times, expressive individualism, New York Times Magazine, 2015 was the year we obsessed over identity. And in December of 2015, a transgender father of 7 children reportedly left his wife and family in Toronto to start a new life. As a woman, no, as a 6-year-old little girl. He said, I identify as a 6-year-old. And I need to be who I am. And this couple who kind of took him in, kind of foster him, said, well, he needs to be who he is. And we're helping him with that. You can Google it. Or I've referenced it at the end. A few months earlier, you may have heard of this case as well, Rachel Dolezal. She was a 37-year-old civil rights activist, black civil rights activist on the face of it. She was accused by her parents of falsely portraying herself as black, of masquerading as black. And they said, actually, this is our little girl. This is a fake. She's not black at all. And Rachel Dolezal admitted reportedly that this is true, but she continued to insist, I still identify as black. You see? So forget the reality. As I look inside, it's what I find. And so I identify as black. The imperialism of the self and the moral quest to express the self and thus be authentic, true to yourself. Now, of course, these are extreme examples, but we don't know the individual stories involved. So I've put in the word repeatedly, reportedly there. I don't know what the real stories are, and we all know some reporters. I don't want to mock these people, but I do think they illustrate a trend which suggests that I identify as is kind of fast becoming a defining, a hallmark feature of our culture. Be yourself, love. You've just got to be yourself. We hear it everywhere. It's entered deep into our psyche. And of course, in the area of sex, male, female, we see Facebook with its multiple ways of you identifying your agenda, which has now got on the end customize. So 50 options. We're running out here. You can go on and on and on. Customize. That kind of sums up expressive individualism. Reality, including the reality of your body. Customize. You customize. Now, when I mention, the whole area of gender dysphoria, which we could then spend a couple of seminars on each of these hot button issues. And I only mention that because I want to say I'm not making any comment on the very small proportion of individuals who experience what we call gender dysphoria. That is a sense of inner dissonance between what their body is, unequivocally. There's no physical anomaly that suggests that their body is any different than a normal male or female body. But inside, they feel this strong sense of dissonance with what they see there. Okay, and we might even be sympathetic in the sense of giving a hearing to the idea that one way, if someone is really traumatized and pained by this, one way might be if it would help them to live as the person that they feel themselves to be, we may want to hear their story and listen sympathetically. And I don't want to get into that right now. What I do want to get into, though, is gender ideology. The big mistake I think we're making as a church is, once again, we're getting drawn into the individual examples. We should be focusing on the ideology behind it that drives it. And what we're doing is we're using these difficult cases, our society, to construct a whole ideology that, because these few people have problem lining up who they are with their body, we're going to redefine our whole concept of male and female. That our sense of sex isn't rooted in our physical body. Now, that view of the world works for the vast majority of people, 99% of people. That works just fine. But in order, we think, to help the 1%, we change this whole understanding of what sex is and impose it on the 99%. And on children, who haven't been worrying whether they're male and female, but we're imposing an ideology on them, and nobody quite knows what the end game is. Now, what I'm saying is, we don't have to resolve all the questions about the 1%. We don't have to get drawn too far into that. You don't have to understand everything about transgender to be able to say that, there's some questions down here for the 1%. I want to talk about the 99%. I want to ask why and what benefit it's bringing to the 99% of kids to tell them that sex isn't what they clearly see to be the case, and for the vast majority of our kids feel to be the case in terms of what their body tells them. And the reason I want to raise that is simply because I care about kids' well-being, you can say. And I'm not saying I've got all the answers, but I think before we go down this road, let's think a bit more. So what I want to encourage us to do is not get drawn into the 1% cases before we've seen the ideology that it's spawning, that it's giving rise to. And we need to engage with the ideology, most of all. And you may want to talk about that a bit later. But I think this area of gender, rather than land too much on it as a hot button issue, illustrates this broader cultural shift, which is I identify as is the hallmark of the modern psyche, of our spirit of the age. And as these two big cultural developments converge and interact together, individualism and this moral vision of authenticity, they actually make for really inspiring dramas, don't they? They make great films and sitcoms, rom-coms, and Friends and Will and Grace and Alan Turing's The what was it called again? The Imitation Game. And these all of them are it's the same storyline that's woven together, which is about freedom. Freedom. Being yourself. And this guy, Alan Turin, he possibly saves your life, is the message of the film, in terms of what he achieved in the war. And what did you do? He's picked up for being different for you. And you told him he either goes to prison or we pump you with drugs. And he got the drugs and then he died of cyanide poisoning 2 years later. It's a great story. It's a story of freedom. It's calling us to break free. And that's our narrative that we've got to come to terms with. And in response to stories like that, we issue lists of facts. And so once again, the two don't talk to one another. We haven't got any stories to tell. We haven't got anything that people can quite relate to, that draws them in, that for a moment allows them to suspend the way they're looking at the world and just through the story you tell, begin to look at it through another lens. You see? So when Jesus says, you know, there's a man. He had two sons. You see, he's got you. There's a story. And you're ready to enter into another world now and to look at it through lens. But what we tend to do in this whole area of morality is they've got great stories out there and we've got facts. And if you talk to Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, he says much of what people believe out there, they hold in their heads as a storyline. They don't hold lists of facts. They tend to have lots of stories about the way the world works and is. And he says the problem is you can't outstory a story with facts. You've got to tell a different story, a better story. And that, I think, is the challenge that really sits square before us at the moment, because marriage, kids, sex, relationships, you know, we have a sermon on it once a year. This is a core business of our humanity. Sex, it's such a big part of our lives, and we shuffle our kids off once a year to have an awkward talk about it. No stories, few facts, often shrouded in shame. And I don't know, most of you are probably brought up like me on what you might call the starvation diet in relation to the gospel's view of sex and marriage. If I said, you know, who here, as part of the Christian growth and education, were given an inspiring picture of the essential goodness of their erotic longings as a teenager, those pulls toward people, the way the body changes. Now, who here was given in the Christian worldview an inspiring vision of the essential goodness in God's economy of those longings? Hands up. You see, you were, and later on, and it there's usually one or two, you know. And you, brilliant. But as teenagers, you know, it comes a bit later in. But what we're wanting as teenagers is someone to talk to. Well, we don't really want someone to talk to us, but we do at another level. And what we do is we bring up our kids on the starvation diet. Okay? And the world comes along, Hugh Hefner comes along, he says, forget all that. We've got fast food. We're going to do fast food here. And the human spirit, if you've got an option between the starvation diet and the fast food, which are you going to go for? And so we've got some big challenges ahead of us, you see. And one thing we can do is, because of the fast food diet and what we see it doing over here, we can go back to the starvation diet. That's our default, swing back, let's get back to the 50s, the starvation diet, you see. And I think the real challenge is, can we see in the sexual revolution what perhaps a huge blessing to us as a church, that God is speaking to us through the sexual revolution and saying there's a possibility that you can reimagine all over again the biblical narrative of what sex and relationships, marriage, what these things mean for us as human beings in God's economy.